I was able to kind of learn some leadership skills and, you know, things like that in the Marines that I was always kind of interested in. And I think just spurred me to understand, you know, this is another domino. This is someplace you can go and you can impact lives in a great way. You know, you don't have to be in the Marines leading people in the front and, you know, taking charge that way, as you can make an impact. And, you know, I've always kind of had that desire. And, you know, I think it's been a good fit for me, for my life. It's just being able to be a coach and be able to be impactful, and I find purpose in it.
You're listening to Spartan Combat on Spartan Up. Learn from battle-tested combat athletes with your host, Ryan Warner.
Spartans! Welcome back to the combat series here on Spartan Up. This is Ryan Warner. My guest today is one of the top Greco-Roman coaches in the country, Brian Medlin. In this episode, we start off talking about Brian's travels to Russia and then move into some of his core coaching philosophies.
This episode of Spartan Up is brought to you by Honey Stinger, made with organic honey and delicious ingredients. Use the code HSSpartan2020 at honeystinger.com to save 30% off.
Brian Medlin, welcome to the podcast, sir.
Thank you. It's awesome to be on. Love your stuff.
Thank you. Great to have you. If you look at Russia, everyone looks at this massive, massive country, and certainly there's wrestlers all over, but a lot of the great quote-unquote Russian wrestlers are from the Caucasus region, which is Ossetia, and then you have Dagestan, which is the Islamic region down there. But both of those two spots are the real hotbeds. How did you end up getting acquainted with these folks and going over there so regularly?
So I had kind of been going to Russia since, I don't know, the mid-90s. I went over there first to St. Petersburg with a coach of mine in the Marines, and then just kind of kept in contact with the guy that was over there in St. Petersburg. And I was actually going to go to St. Petersburg about the first time I went to Vladikavkaz was about 7 or 8 years ago. And the guy just said, hey, if you're going to come over here for Greco, come to St. Petersburg. But if you're going to go for freestyle, go, you know, find another place in the Caucasus region. So I just kind of started reaching out to people, and, you know, it was a long process. It took, I don't know, it went 5 or 6 layers deep with people. And then I ended up meeting a guy named Akshar Ivanovich. He was an old Belarusian coach, and, you know, he's from there. And, you know, he developed a guy that was living in Chicago at the time, was Lithuanian. And just, I started developing a friendship with him just kind of, you know, organically through, you know, wrestling. And just, he's a great person and just kind of person that I kind of wanted to be around. So, you know, I started talking to him, and then it just kind of went from there, and went over there for the first time. I only took a couple people. Each time I went, I've really only taken a couple people with me. So it's been pretty special. You know, that guy's pretty much like my family now. So, I mean, his kids are my kids and my kids are his kids. And, you know, it's pretty special to have that relationship.
So. Well, I heard you talking to Mark Bader, you know, about this topic and how you talk to this guy every other day now at this point. I mean,
yeah, no.
I mean, not to the letter of the word, but you talk to him a lot, you know?
Yeah, I talk to him probably once a week. You know, he will text me about, you know, what's going on over there. I mean, obviously, they're pretty concerned about what's going on because they get stuff from the media. So they think everybody's writing and there's tons of pandemic everywhere and everybody's going to die. And, you know, they have to check in with me. I think I'm their fact checker now. So him and the rest of coaches just – you know, they get the false information a lot. So yeah, I do get to speak to him quite a bit. You know, his problems would be kind of come, you know, my problems as far as, you know, being able to help financially and, you know, things like that. They're not in the spots that we are. You know, we obviously were born with a lot more, and we just, it's what we have. So we don't really understand, you know, what to struggle looks like. So
how do you mean,
you know, there's also a reason why, you know, those countries like the Caucasus region, that's a hard place to live. You know, it's a hard place to live. And, you know, places like Cuba and, you know, places like that, that develop these great wrestlers out of poverty, you know, there's definitely a correlation between, you know, being able to just wake up and get whatever you want, as opposed to being able to wake up and you gotta fight and struggle. So like it lends itself to making a great wrestler. So
I mean, when you say that, you know, the struggle we have is different than theirs. I mean, is it a poverty or is it just like limited opportunities because of the situation they grew up in? I mean, how do you see that when you go over there?
Well, they look at wrestling as a way out. You know, when you're Olympic champ, you know, world champ, I mean, that's going to be your ticket. You know, that when you do that, you're going to be a coach. You know, you're going to get a good stipend. You're going to get on the national team. You know, people are going to give you a car or a house. You know, it's a way out. Where, you know, our struggle for our kids, it's, you know, there's so many things that they can do with their time that are a lot easier than wrestling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's getting them to intrinsically want to do something hard, you know, and that's difficult to do. So, you know, I don't think either one of them are more difficult than each other. I mean, you fight when you have to fight.
Yeah.
But our kids are being asked to fight and they don't have to. They could just sit at home and play video games and, you know, do stuff like that. And that's a whole nother issue you've got to deal with. So I don't know which one's more difficult.
It's interesting. You know, like you said, everywhere you go, you have your own problems. And you know, that's kind of the foundation that these kids have grown up with. And anytime I interview someone who's grown up in that system or one of the republics, the thing that they always say is that coaching over there is a respected profession and that you can't just have a dad off the street as a coach. You pretty much have to be a world team member to coach.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a world team member, but you have to be a lifelong coach. That there isn't, and that's an issue with the American system, is that even guys that wrestle in college, you know, they'll come back and they'll coach their kids club and they'll do some great things. And then maybe they'll follow that kid to high school and then they'll do some more great things. And then the kid leaves and you never see him again, where that person had a lot to offer. You know, their system is a little bit different, is that they have lifelong coaches. And from what I've saw, and you know, the coaches that these athletes seem to be connected to the most aren't world champs. They're not two-time Olympic or three-time Olympic champs. They're coaches that started that kid off. You know, that when, you know, Sadakov's personal coaches at the practice, you know, they seem to have a connection that's well past wrestling, you know, and they believe in each other and they know each other. They're both vested in the interest of Sadakov's success, you know, almost to the same extent. Mm-hmm. And that's an attribute that we've got to continue to strive for here in the United States, is just getting people to invest in wrestling longer, you know, and not just when it just fits their needs, you know. And I feel like that's something, if we attacked it the right way, we could do a lot better job at it.
Well, it goes with one of your tenets of, you know, your goal is to make lifelong wrestlers. And one of the things you said about the first time you went to Russia, you know, you grew up in Peoria and a lot of people there, you know, we're from Central Illinois. It's a workman mentality, get the 9 to 5 and just suck it up. But you, when you went to Russia, you go, I didn't know if I was allowed to love wrestling this much. And it kind of gave you permission to really love wrestling. And that was something I've been thinking about it ever since I heard you say it. What did you mean by that? And how did that transpire when you went to Russia?
Well, I didn't know wrestling was that big. I mean, being from Central Illinois, I mean, to be honest, like, I didn't have the same things that are out there right now as far as exposure goes. Like, I just didn't know. Like, I would read those USA Wrestling newspapers that you would get, and mm-hmm. I would love it, and it just seemed like a different world that I was so far removed from. My dad wasn't an athlete. My uncles weren't athletes. You know, we're from a very blue collar family, you know, and we're work ethic and working hard. That goes above everything, more than touchdowns or takedowns or whatever. So I didn't know wrestling was that big. And then I started traveling overseas in Japan and got to go to Russia and some different places where wrestling is huge, you know, and you have these giant populations of people that just love it. And I was just, man, I can really make this into my life. Like, I can, it's okay. Cause I always kind of felt a kinship towards it. But at the same time, I was always in the back of my mind hearing like my father and my uncles and everything else. It's just a sport. It's just a game, you know? And I think it just gave me permission that, hey, this great big population, you know, it's making it part of their life. And, you know, it's okay to get into this thing and make it who you are, you know, let it develop you into a better person and develop you into the kind of person you want to be.
Man, it's so cool that you had that opportunity to see that. And that was all through the Marines. Was your first time really getting exposure to that?
Yeah. Yeah. In the Marines, actually, I wasn't even on the team the first time. I was in Japan, and I was just kind of sightseeing on my own, and went to this giant Buddha outside of Tokyo and was just sitting there, and this guy saw my cauliflower and ended up being one of the national coaches for Japan. I feel like, honestly, like thinking about it, I've led a pretty blessed life that like just these things happened, you know, and not just happened, you know, there were opportunities that I was able to kind of take advantage of. And then I got to know him and his family, and, you know, we'd go over there for Sunday dinner, and, you know, it was an awesome experience. And he took me to all the national camps and practices and things like that. I would meet him on the weekends. So that was kind of my first big eye-opening experience. And then from there, you know, getting to go to Russia and Sweden and Finland and places like that, you know, and it was, it just took off from there. You know, I knew that this was a great sport, and it had some great lessons, and, you know, I wanted to kind of pass them on and take them in. So.
Well, you're definitely in, you've said this, you're a true coach, and you treat it as a craft. And you've got to study these national teams. And as you said, you were in Tokyo for upwards of 6 months. How does that system compare to what you've seen when you go to Ossetia?
I guess the difference I saw, like just with the little things that they did, there was a lot more like the idea of practice. There was a lot of respect. I mean, not that there wasn't respect in Russia and America and everything else. There's some like idiosyncratic, like little things that they do, you know, like I'll say, I didn't know for the first couple of times this guy was coming up and he kept shaking my hand before practice, and he would like bow and then he would leave. And I was just like, this is the friendliest guy I know. And then like three practices later, the coach comes over, who speaks American English, and he was like, yeah. You know, that guy's getting upset because he keeps asking you to practice with him, and you keep turning him down. And I'm like, I didn't know what he was talking about. Like that whole like double handshake, you know, trying to be lower than you. You know, I started to kind of learn their traditions and things like that. It's pretty cool. You know, they bow a lot, and you know, there's a lot of respect and a lot of really cool things. And they're inventive. Like I'll say, like it was one of the most inventive type practices where people were in there and they're just trying stuff and not just trying stuff without a purpose. Like you could tell they put some thought into it between practices, and they were developing new technique. And, you know, they were at the time, Japan had some guys that were really good in parterre and top, and I saw them develop it. It was pretty cool watching it.
Has any of the countries you've been to put as much emphasis on weightlifting and strength training as we do?
No, not really. I mean, strength training in kind of a different way. You know, I think they're very consistent. You know, speaking of like Vladikov guys, they climb ropes like crazy. They do pull-ups like crazy, you know, mm-hmm. And they're starting to get into some weightlifting and things like that. In Dagestan, they've got a lot of like outdoor gyms. They're starting to get a little bit more into it. I see their videos. They've got circuit training and things like that, but no one trains the way we train as far as just specific weight training. I didn't see a lot of people heavy deadlifting, squatting, you know, things like that, you know, and I don't think it's wrong. I will say, like, I don't think that they would spend as much time doing it as opposed to getting better at their craft of wrestling. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of their mentality. The more I spend time lifting weights, I'm not getting my single leg better. So, but it seems like our bodies hold up pretty well. And I think a lot of it has to do with the high level of understanding of how the body works and strength training and things like that.
But to your point, it's just a different strength. I mean, I've seen videos of Kudakov, rest in peace, obviously. He can do a muscle up. He can, you know, on the rings, it's like a gymnast up there. And I'm sure Gilman could do the same thing, but I just think there's different, and maybe he couldn't, but I'm pretty sure he could. There's just different levels of the strength and the flexibility, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, it's something that when a guy grabs you, you understand this guy has muscles that were developed in a gym, and you have muscles that were developed, you know, over time doing things like, you know, gripping things that are heavy and lifting yourself off a rope and things like that. So, yeah. You know, it's definitely a different kind of strength, but, you know, and I don't think we're doing it wrong. I just think that there's, you know, something to be learned from both.
Yeah. And just to kind of close the loop on this subject, you've been going so long, and I know you're very analytical, so you probably have sheets worth of things that we're doing wrong and they're doing right. But if you had to just kind of look back on the past 15 minutes of our conversation, whether it's the kid tournaments, the training, or just the mentality, what are a couple of things that we could do right now to improve our game, in your opinion?
You know, obviously at the kids level, I've been very, I've watched it really closely and thought a lot about it. You know, I think two of the things that we touched on just now, you know, the first thing is, you know, just taking results out of the equation earlier, you know, especially when kids are first started wrestling, and everybody says it, but nobody applies it to the sport as much. You know, I think having a kid look at, hey man, you're scoring points in matches, you know, you're going out there and you're trying stuff, that's a success. You know, not, hey, did you win that 2-1 match? Or, you know, you gotta get tougher and meaner and everything else. You know, there's a time and place for that, but skill building at a young age, that's instrumental. And I just don't think we teach kids how to win way too early, and we don't put enough emphasis on the actual craft of wrestling. You know, and I think there could be there could be something learned in that. And it takes a while. It's not something you can do in a 3-month sport. You know, that's one thing about every one of those countries that are doing really well. I mean, their development is year round. You know, they start and, you know, when they're young, and once they're into wrestling, they're kind of into it forever. You know, there is no season, and, you know, kind of back and forth, and it doesn't culminate into this giant tournament where there's tons of pressure and then they take 6 months off. I was at their place when they had their cadet regional tournament, and, you know, their best cadets were there the next day, you know, mm-hmm. They maybe weren't, you know, going live, but they were there the next day talking about their practices. You know, I see a lot of kids, you know, once the state tournament's over and IQBF or, you know, wherever else, you don't see them for 4 months sometimes, you know,
sometimes a lot longer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something we could do a lot better than, and just being able to create, you know, lifelong coaches and, you know, people that are involved with wrestling. You know, it doesn't even have to be a coach, but somebody that's involved with wrestling that, you know, like you're doing, you know, you're changing a lot of people's perspective on wrestling with what you're doing. You're not on a mat every single day, but we need people involved with wrestling and, you know, helping to continue to grow. And I think we're on the right path, but we got to get everybody all hands on deck as much as we can.
Well, I appreciate that. And it means a lot that you even listen to the show. One of the things I was most curious about you is, how did you get involved with coaching, essentially? So I know you placed fifth at state, I think in like 94, you went to the Marine. I only know because my man, Jesse Montes, who was one of my high school coaches, he was in, I don't think he was in your bracket, but Geneseo had a squad back then. And like Brad Shinowski, do you remember that guy?
Yeah, man, I do.
But I mean, that's also one of my favorite times of Illinois wrestling. You had TJ Williams, Tony Davis, you know, Ben Yen. That's just a great time to be in Illinois wrestling. So you go, you join the Marines. How do you make the jump from that to running Team Illinois and all the Fargo stuff and being like one of the staples in the mid 2000s?
Well, I think, you know, a couple of things. I was in the right place, and I kind of met the right people that spurred my passion for coaching. You know, I would be at the training center training, or, you know, would go sneak into the freestyle practice and watch it. You know, I was in places where there were great coaches, so I was able to watch it. And one of the things, and I've thought a little bit about the fact that, like, I wasn't a great wrestler, but I think that's allowed me a little bit to step back, because I don't have an ego about what I've done. You know, mm-hmm. I think a lot of great wrestlers don't end up becoming great coaches because they kind of get stuck in the fact that, like, you have to do things this way because this is what I did. You know, and I think you get a little bit closed-minded, and I've always been able to kind of have an open mind because I've got no background in it, you know. So, but I was able to kind of learn some leadership skills and, you know, things like that in the Marines that I was always kind of interested in, and I think just spurred me to understand, you know, this is another domino. This is someplace you can go and you can impact lives in a great way. You know, you don't have to be in the Marines leading people in the front and, you know, taking charge that way, as you can make an impact. And, you know, I've always kind of had that desire. And, you know, I think it's been a good fit for me, for my life. It's just being able to be a coach and be able to be impactful, and I find purpose in it.
I mean, I think a lot of the guys who have wrestled for you would say the same. And a lot of people have told me before this, who I've reached out to, how much of an impact you've made. But it seems like one of the big turning points for me was like 2007, you were still an assistant at Washington, right?
Yeah.
And that was like the year you guys didn't have any qualifiers. And then the next year you took over. I only know because that was my senior year in high school. But anyway, so 2007, my senior year, I'm getting ready to leave and do whatever. You're sitting in the stands plotting, and then you take over as head coach the next year. Is that right?
I believe so.
Yeah. So it's a, I mean, for a lot of people who know you as the Team Illinois guy or the Illinois RTC guy, you know, you took over a team in Central Illinois, Washington, that never, you know, really didn't do much of wrestling before that. And then after you were done, they had won the regionals like 7 or 8 times, won state a couple of times. And I mean, how many times did you guys take second at Montini?
Oh, it was like our nemesis, but we weren't really nemesis to them. So it just mattered like when we met them, like we were going to be out of the state tournament in the first round or second round or whenever. So I think, it was hard. It was hard watching him. He does a great job with that program.
I think
he's part of it. You know, a guy like Izzy watching him coach, you know, I think that was part of my progress, is just being able to watch and see people that had great programs. I think a couple things happened right about then. I met Mike Powell that ooh, summer.
Ooh.
Yeah, no, he's awesome. And I think, I once again kind of found out there's whole new levels to coaching, you know, watching him and the way he was able to get his guys to compete for him and, you know, was able to get guys to rally around a certain cause or whatever, you know, there's a craft in that and he's one of the best. So being able to be around him and being able to, you know, see that there's more to coaching than just showing a single leg or whatever, you know. And I kind of always wanted to be more than a wrestling coach to kids. You know, I think that was something to get them to buy into a program that actually made a difference in their lives. So I think building that program and that culture was huge, you know, and having good people. I had a great assistant coach who's the head coach now, Nick Miller. He was young and we didn't have kids at the time. So we could just go and just wrestle all weekend and, you know, stay at the school till 10 o'clock every night and get there at 5 o'clock every morning and just do that over and over and over again and just kind of get kids that were good enough and, you know, that wanted to buy into your culture. So
what was your first impression when you saw Mike Powell walk around practice just screaming at the top of his lungs, man?
I thought he was a giant blowhard, to be honest. Like I it was funny because I was actually I was coaching a kid from like Central Illinois. It was my first kid I ever coached, really. Jeff Bybee, was kind of around him, not doing too much, just practicing really kind of one-on-one. And he went to one of the state tournaments, whether it's freestyle or Greco, I don't remember. But I remember watching Ellis and Tony Ramos wrestle in the first round of this tournament. And I was like, holy cow, I couldn't believe how good they both were. And, you know, I actually sought Mike out because I wanted Ellis to practice with my guy. Because I was like, that guy's, he's special. Like, he was mean and dirty and gritty and just athletic and just had everything. I thought this guy is going to be what he's become, really, which is, you know, a world caliber wrestler. So and went up to Mike and, you know, just from that day on, I think we've talked, you know, a couple times a week, and I've been lucky to be on the end of those conversations.
Dude, I remember Jeff Bybee. He lost a finger in a shop accident, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Unbelievable.
And then he just developed new ways to grab things. It was awesome. Yeah. Like he would just figure out new grip ways and, you know, things like that. Yeah, he was pretty special. He was awesome too.
So this all kind of happens during that time. And one of the things I want to know in a very simple way, like how did you change the program so quickly? Was it the kids club starting? I mean, was it year round? I mean, I know some guys moved in later, like Randy Miniweather, who was a kid I used to know, but kids weren't moving in right away and you were still having success. Like what happened?
Yeah, no, I mean, the big thing is the year round start. I mean, we never, even when I was in high school, or, you know, not even, I didn't know anything about summer wrestling or anything like that. But like, we didn't have those resources. So we would go, you know, from the time I got there until the time I left, you know, and it still happens now, is that it's just, they look at it different. They look at the sport a little bit differently, that it's not just a sport, that it's a way of life. And then also, you know, we started to gain momentum and get a little bit better. And you take pride in that, in the fact that they're building something great, you know, and that they were the first ones, you know, and they kind of wanted to be that first group, you know. And there were some interesting characters on those first two teams that weren't great wrestlers, but, you know, they just gave great effort and were just awesome to be around, and they just kind of fed off each other. So I think just being year round.
Yeah. Well, it's something where if you're not from Illinois, you don't really get, but, you know, south of I-80 is kind of the demarcation line of what some people consider good wrestling and not. And I was right on the border, and a lot of the tournaments we went to were in that, you know, where you're from, you know, so we're pretty much from the same area. So it's just so unique to see a Central Illinois dynasty kind of come to fruition. And, you know, you did that for many years. You guys were battling OPRF, you were battling Montini. One of the things that happened that I would just love to get your thought process on was when you were coaching the day before a big duel with Oak Park, you actually had a house catch on fire. It was your house. No one died, but your house was burnt to the ground. And I'm not just asking for the wow factor. I want to understand how you got through that, but what happened, I guess. And then we'll kind of talk about how you processed it.
So yeah, I was actually setting up for that duel. It was on the 23rd, and the house caught fire on the 22nd. I was leaving school. We had a big duel, like, in an auditorium. It was, you know, we put a lot into it. It's a big fundraiser for the club and for the team and everything. And my wife called and she was like, "Hey, the house is on fire." And I'm like thinking to myself, like, it's just a little thing. And I looked up and I'm, you know, 10, 15 miles away at the time. And I look up and I can see smoke like 10 or 15 miles off in the distance. You know, Illinois is pretty flat.
Yeah.
So, and it was just kind of crazy making those turns on the way home. Just every turn, you kind of turned away from it and then you went to it. And so by the time I got there, it was completely engulfed. And, you know, yeah, it was surreal. You know, it was just an electrical fire that started in our garage. It was an older house, and just, yeah, you get there and you start to kind of realize that these things I've been telling these kids for years, you know, like, hey, you got to be tough in these moments when, you know, everybody's looking at you and need you to stand up and be a man and blah, blah, blah. I think I just given some speech like that in the past couple of days. And I get there and, like, my wife and kids just have these giant eyes, and, you know, they were just like looking for something, you know, positive for me. And I think I was able to kind of draw on those experiences and lead our family, you know, in the way that wrestling's taught us. So,
well, you had said even in a quote that you went from, like, self-pity to how do we solve this right away. But I think a lot of people get stuck in the self-pity for days, if not months and years after something like that. It could be a fire, a death, whatever. I mean, and so if you had to look back, what enabled you to get through that so quickly? Or if someone's listening to this and they're stuck, you know, holidays are a tough time. How do you get out of that self-pity?
I think it's the same way. Like, if you look at a big tournament, you know, we talk about this and just equate it back to wrestling, is that, you know, if you try to win a big tournament, there's tons of things that have to happen the right way. Like, you have to, you know, you have to travel, and there has to be, you know, figure out how you're going to get there, what your weight's going to be, what you're going to eat the night before, what, you know, if you made a checklist, there's like 1,000 things you got to do right to actually win that tournament. And I think, like, that's really what you do. You don't really look at, like, hey, I want to win this tournament, or hey, I want to build a new house, you know, or hey, what are we? You just look for one thing. Like, we didn't, for us, I can still remember it. It was toothbrushes. Like, that was the thing, you know, like, what do we do? Well, we got to get toothbrushes. Everybody's got to brush their teeth tonight. We had a, you know, what do we need? We need toothbrushes. We need soap, you know, things like that. You know, obviously we had a place to stay because my mom lives pretty close to there. So we knew we were going to stay there that night. And I think you just build from there, you know, and you just look for that next right thing to do or to get or to whatever. And, you know, it's pretty easy to kind of, you know, feel sorry for yourself and to get down and, you know, think about what you've lost or what's at stake or whatever. But if you just kind of think about it and break it down into little pieces, they're manageable. And I think everybody kind of understands that. It's just hard to do in those moments where it's chaos, you know, like there's a blazing house in front of you, and it doesn't have to be a blazing house. It just has to be something's in front of you. It's hard to take a breath, calm down, and do the right thing. But that's what this sport has always taught us, right? Is just it's going to get crazy. The fans are going to yell and the close score is going to be way closer than you want it to be. And there's going to be overtime, a bad call that's going to put you in overtime. Take a breath, take a deep breath, get back to the basics and just do, find one right thing to do right away. And I think that that was the key for us. And, you know, it worked. So.
Toothbrush. That's what is a starting point. It's like something you don't even think twice about. Now it's, that's what you're getting to, you know, that's your end goal.
Yeah. But I mean, how many great matches are won with just a collar tie?
Yeah.
Just the way the guy's making contact, you know, I mean, it's not special. It's not, you know, very, doesn't need to be this great, big, elaborate plan. It just can be simple, like make contact lower than him, you know, change your level.
Yeah, so. Man, it, but things like that, it's just, I mean, thank God you had a family and had money for a hotel. If you stayed in a hotel, like what if you didn't have any of that? You know, what if you had no family and you had no money in the bank and you were just stranded out there? You know, it just really makes you appreciative for what you do have.
Yeah. And that was where probably the biggest factor is we had people that cared. I think all those years of, you know, staying with these kids and going up to their, you know, to meets and taking them to this place, or, you know, being a parent for them if they needed one, or being, you know, a support system if they needed one, you know, that's when they came back to me, you know, and I couldn't imagine doing it alone, you know, but for us, we're such a tight knit group, the wrestling community. It feels like when something bad happens to one of our own, we fight to get to be the people that help them. So, you know, I think if you're involved in the sport, you're not alone. You know, if you're listening to this podcast, I guarantee you're not alone. You have teammates and you have coaches and you have people that care about you.
Absolutely. Ah, that's awesome. Now, switching gears a little bit, you're at the University of Illinois right now. Is that right? Huff Hall?
Yep. I'm in Huff Hall's basement. I tried to do it in the wrestling room, but it was a little bit noisy in there. So,
well, we appreciate it. And, you know, it's very exciting for Illinois fans to have you there. I mean, what's going on right now at Illinois is really exciting, especially last year, some of the momentum with the duels, you got the Braunagels in there. How did you come to this position and what's your primary focus right now?
My primary focus, I coach the regional training center guys. So like our senior level athletes that are trying to make world and Olympic teams. I'm not really sure how I came to the job, to be honest. Like,
or why'd you take it? I guess what got you excited about it? Because I'm sure you had tons of offers before that. I mean, why'd you?
It felt right. Well, it was the year of that fire, and I think a lot of my focus that it was the next year. It was 2018 or 17, whatever year that was. You know, I think I took a step back in you know, especially when I saw how powerful the wrestling community was and things like that, and I knew the guy that was the assistant under me, he needed to be a head coach. So it was just easy to step back. That ship was running itself. And to be honest, like I wanted to do something else great in wrestling. And I knew they needed somebody in here that was going to be consistent. They were kind of starting from no athletes, no money, and that you kind of had to build something. So that excited me. So that's why I took it. I'm still a little confused that I don't want to like ask why they hired me. I'm just to make sure that, you know, I'm still here. You know, I just feel lucky every day. At first I would come in and I'd just be like scared I was going to do something wrong and get fired. Cause it's such an awesome job. So I love it.
It's awesome that someone like you still feels imposter syndrome, because there's no way you should be feeling imposter syndrome based on what you've done, but it sounds like you still feel that even a little bit, you know, even adults feel that, I guess.
Yeah, no, I definitely feel it. You know, I love this job. I definitely want to do a good job and be able to kind of leave something better, you know, for the next person. So I think, you know, Illinois has always had great freestyle and Greco. And I think being able to have a place that they know they can get what they need, whether it's going to Ossetia or going to Hungary or, you know, wherever, we'll go to the end of the earth to make sure our guys get whatever they need.
This episode of Spartan Up is brought to you by Honey Stinger, made with organic honey and delicious ingredients. Use the code HSSpartan2020 at honeystinger.com to save 30% off.